Global News Headquarters, this is the Global News Network with Senior Correspondent Jeff Weaver and Senior Correspondent Adam von Roemer.
Mr. Weaver, here we find ourselves back at the International Global News Desk for the Omaha Bugle.
Well, Adam, it's a great day to be alive and be able to impart knowledge and wisdom to our listeners. And I think we have a particularly entertaining, interesting topic today, which I guess we could say is something I had wondered about before. That is, what is the world's most dangerous job? And
I was going to say, hold on, don't jump ahead now, damn it. Now, I looked at your most recent article on Newsmax, and I have to applaud the erudition and research that went into that article. And the first question I have is, and it's like, what in the wide, wide world of sports even possessed you to take a look at the most dangerous jobs in the world?
Well, Adam, I think I was thinking about how unpleasant my own job is at times. And I was thinking how other white-collar workers who work in air-conditioned offices must suffer. And I thought, I wonder if our jobs are anywhere near the top in terms of people deciding to do themselves in, being depressed or whatever, although I don't know if suicide counts as making it the world's most dangerous job. But for whatever reason, I was curious as to what jobs were in that upper echelon of fatalities. Maybe it was a little bit of a morbid curiosity, but I think it was also prompted by some of these reality shows that I've seen on TV, and one of which I mentioned in the article, The Deadliest Catch Show, where you see these fishermen getting pummeled by gale force winds, and these crab pots are swinging around. And I think a couple of those episodes, they had people go overboard, too. So I thought, well, they may have.
Oh, yeah. There was one episode I watched. There was one episode I watched, Jeff, where one of the guys on the boat was a Native American. Mm-hmm. And apparently, and this is, I know this is a little afield from what we're talking about here, but apparently in Alaskan waters, if you are a native and you come across a walrus that they found floating in the sea, obviously the walrus had expired. If you are a native, you can go in and harvest the tusks from the walrus. And this guy literally took off all of his cold weather gear, tied a rope around his waist, essentially, and jumped into the water, landing on top of the bloated and putrefying walrus to harvest that particular tusk. And I mean, everybody on the boat's going absolutely nuts because your life expectancy in that water is 37 seconds. And he's floating around in that water effectively, naked. I mean, he still had clothes on, but he didn't have any of his protective gear on. And he actually harvested the tusk. And I'm like, that job requires a certain, let's say, loose grip on sanity to begin with. And then to further take off all of your flotation device is whatever, your cold weather gear, and dive into icy cold water to retrieve a tusk. I got news for you, man. If it was me, that tusk would still be floating around out there. There's no damn way I'd be diving in that. Nope.
Well, you kind of wonder, too, what is the value of getting the tusk? Is it something for their tribal rituals, or is it just something to sell to people who buy elephant tusk and things like that illegally, I presume?
No, I think there was a spiritual, sociological, I don't know how best to couch that, but significance in that whole process, holy.
I don't really know how to respond to that. That's something I never would have thought anybody would have done, particularly with the carcass rotting on the surface of the ocean.
Apparently they do continue to putrefy as they're floating around in that icy cold water. That's an unnecessary trip down a different. Here's the deal. You came up with a list of the most dangerous jobs on essentially on the planet. And yeah, I get the, you know, crab pot fishing in Alaska. I mean, you're in just terrible, terrible weather. It's cold, rainy. You could get taken out by one of those crab pots, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the one that kind of surprised me was loggers. Loggers have the highest death rate until we get to the last part, but loggers have the highest death rate.
Well again, remember that this list that I got came from the U.S. Census Bureau. So they first dealt, or we were dealing with the top three deadliest jobs in the U.S. And then surprise to this whole thing is the fourth job, if you will, that really is not in the U.S. But it was interesting to see, as you said, where the highest fatality rates were. And yeah, I was kind of surprised to see that loggers have the highest rate of death among any type of occupation in the United States. I think it's like 82 deaths per 100,000 workers. You know, let's face it, a lot of times they get hit by a big tree landing on them. And trees are heavy. People don't seem to realize it, but trees can be very heavy when they fall over on you.
Trees landing on you are bad news.
They are bad news. They land on your cars, bad news for your cars too. But yeah, primarily the loggers would die from trees falling on them. I guess they don't yell timber loud enough or whatever when they cut those trees. You know, loggers driving around in those transport vehicles, you know, run over other loggers. And then they have the wood saws, which can be a bit of a problem, and people can get hurt or maimed or killed by venturing too close to the wood saws. So the other thing, I don't know if you've ever seen those trucks rolling down the highways where they've got the log stack.
Like
a pyramid or whatever. And those things sometimes collapse. And, you know, if you happen to be the unfortunate logger who's fiddling around with the truck, you get crushed. So it apparently is pretty dangerous. And my guess is, although I didn't see a reference to this in the census materials, is that you probably have loggers that perhaps drown, you know, when they're floating these logs down rivers and stuff, to the extent that they even do. You know, people trying to move things around, they get crushed between floating logs. So,
well, you know, I watched, I don't know what they called it. Let's just say it's Northwoods Timber or something like that on the Discovery Channel, where they're hooking up the logs to this device, which is just essentially a boom with a bunch of steel cables and some chain. And they were dragging some logs up and that cable snapped.
Ooh.
Now, that cable looks to me to be probably close to an inch in diameter. And I got to believe that dragging a log up a hill, more accurately, the side of a mountain, and that, I think they call them chokers. If that choker pops off, there's a pretty good chance that somebody's getting hurt. And I personally haven't seen it, but, you know, I know that there are incidences that have been reported, I'm sure, where people have actually been decapitated or they've actually been, you know, substantially, let's say, remodeled because they got caught by one of those chains.
Remodeled.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, listen, I think that's probably not, you know, it's probably being generous in it. I can see the potential for bad things happening.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
And then, of course,
really
bad things. Right behind the loggers, we have the previously mentioned fishing and hunting group. And, you know, it's no big surprise. You're on the water, so you've got the danger of your ship sinking right off the bat. And we talk about hostile conditions that fishermen often labor in, making reference to the deadliest catch show. But, you know, frankly, a lot of people fall overboard. A lot of people slip. You know, if you get in high winds, it's not surprising to me because we certainly see enough people, usually honeymooners, one of the honeymooners falling off one of the cruise ships. So I'm guessing it must be more dangerous on these fishing vessels.
I never even gave that consideration. But yeah, I mean, it seems to me as though there is a lot of, you know, there's a lot of issues where, you know, honeymooner does, in fact, go overboard.
Well, Adam, whenever you were on a honeymoon, did you ever take a cruise ship or anything?
No, I actually did not.
It was probably
smart. No. Yeah, I was going to say, on one of my honeymoons, I went on a camping expedition, and that's about the closest I came to the water. Of course, we had a torrential downpour. I was in, I believe, Dover, Delaware, and the campground flooded. So I woke up in the morning and found that I was floating in about 6 inches of water.
And the marital bliss.
So that's probably about the closest. Oh yeah, just and the hits just keep on coming. I went out and chased down our cooler, which had floated away, and you know, I hadn't secured it properly. Apparently, there you have it.
You know, when you think about it, with the fishing guys or fishers, I guess is the more inclusive word instead of fishermen.
Oh, we have to be politically correct here.
Well, you know, fishers is a word that I think That doesn't sound bad to me. You know, some words they just get. What I don't like is when we try to create these really awkward, bloated words to sort of be more inclusive, and they just don't really, you know, clarify anything. But
fishers of ambiguous gender.
Well, the church is very welcoming to all sorts of people, so I've been told. The other thing that surprised me with these fisher people is that they, of course, have these hydraulic haulers and winches on the deck, and occasionally a line can malfunction, and you have one of those things whipsawing around, and as you say, somebody can lose their head, lose their torso, or whatever, because it's like being sliced in half. I'm just thinking, that's got to be a real bad ending to a work day when that happens.
Yeah, it's not like you get to go home and complain to your significant other that it's like, oh, God, it was a tough day at work. I got chopped in the head and,
But the interesting thing was they kind of grouped fishers and hunters together. And obvious things with the hunters is that, you know, there are hunting accidents. People will actually shoot other hunters who they'll mistaken for big game, particularly after a few drinks, or they, they can hit deer on highways. You know, we've all done that once or twice, and that can be dangerous. But basically, they come up with a death rate collectively, the hunters and the fishers. It's a little bit less punitive than those of the loggers, but it's about 75 deaths per 100,000 workers. Mm-hmm. Apparently, though, hunters also die a lot when they fall out of the trees that they are perched in waiting for deer or other game to wander by. I didn't know that was a big cause of death, but apparently so.
Well, you know, I actually lived in central Pennsylvania for a while, and there's a lot of hunting activity going up where, you know, where I live. And there was a report of a hunter that actually ran into town with one of his friends who had, you know, actually been injured during a hunt. And, you know, at the emergency room, certainly the doctor was looking at him with a, you know, an expression of concern on his face. And, you know, he told his buddy that the prognosis wasn't, you know, good for his survival. And he said, well, you know, maybe if you hadn't gutted him before you brought him in here, he'd have had a better chance of survival. So, given the nature of those type of people, listen, I had a hunter blow a hole in a tree 6 feet off of my porch one time, and he couldn't understand why I was upset about it.
Oh, I'm glad you got some new neighbors.
Yeah, I was actually living out in the country. It was absolutely beautiful until hunting season. But anyhow, you know, I get that. I get that. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things going on. You know, you've got weapons. Usually hunters go out fully lubricated. There are some responsible ones, but, you know, occasionally it seems like, you know, we have some issues with people going out there irresponsibly and, doing things they shouldn't be doing.
Right.
But anyhow, enough of that. So we've got the top couple of
boo-boos. Yeah,
boo-boos.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the one you turned up with that absolutely boggles my mind with the sheer numbers. And, you know, in all fairness, this is not something that you did lightheartedly because, you know, I know your background with economics and statistics and, you know, certainly the books you've written on all that. And Jeff, I mean, tell me, you know, based on what you're telling me about the Russian oligarchs, it seems like their mortality rate is hundreds of times higher.
Well, you know, part of the thing, Adam, is there aren't a lot of oligarchs to begin with. And, you know, you get into this, how do you define an oligarch? Because you got to figure out how many people you're dealing with and then the number of fatalities before you get any real meaningful sense of how dangerous it is to be an oligarch. So what I was looking at were what reputable publications such as Forbes were defining as oligarchs. And in at the beginning of 2022, I think Forbes had said there were around 69 oligarchs and 80-something billionaires in Russia. That's probably changed a bit because of all the sanctions in the wake of the Ukraine war. A lot of the oligarchs have lost a significant amount of their fortunes. They've had assets such as yachts impounded, seized, whatever. And so we can only go off. The Forbes numbers are probably the most reliable ones. But again, it's how you define it. So I think we're basically looking at people who are the tops of major companies. This is really heavily toward the energy industry, you know, the major energy companies in Russia. So the big shots in there, you'll see an occasional, like a software guy, you'll see an occasional politician who's managed to be both influential and very, very entrepreneurial in lining his foreign bank accounts with funds. And And but basically, the way, not only do they define in terms of dollar amounts, but they kind of look at it as people who've had some kind of relationship with Vladimir Putin. You know, people who essentially hitch their train to Putin, essentially have ridden it up as Putin has ascended. And, you know, Putin's pretty much a dictator. You know, he's pretty much got absolute power at this point. And a lot of these people benefited from their association with Putin. Adam, you remember that when the Soviet Union collapsed, suddenly there were all these state enterprises that certain people were buying at very, very reduced rates who happened to have an in with the government. And
you mean like Gazprom?
Gazprom, yes, indeed.
I think you and I could have rolled our quarters and bought that.
I wish we had. It would have been a great return on the quarters. But
exactly.
So anyways, so you have to kind of start with how you're defining who an oligarch is. So they're tied in with Putin. They're politically prominent. They sit atop one of the major companies. They have hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars. And again, it's all not clear as to who has what, because, you know, they're trying to hide it. You know, if they're doing a halfway decent job, we're not going to really exactly what they have. But it's those type of guys. And what was really surprising, and I guess this was the reason for the article now that I think about it, was that you just kept hearing about people in Russia who were prominent politicians, businessmen, you know, military.
Would one call that an apparatchik?
I don't know, actually. That strikes me as a more political, I don't know. I'm not really sure the answer to that.
You think it's more of a political, financially incentivized political grifter?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm not really sure. I think you have to be pretty good at climbing your way to the top, and you got to be pretty good at being a buddy of Putin's and not getting killed, or at least trying not to get killed. But, you know, I think there's certainly some combination of political toadying, if you want to call it that, and perhaps maybe there's some degree of business acumen in there in some ways. I mean, I couldn't really say. But what was surprising, though, was over and over and over again, we kept hearing about, you know, these high-ranking business officials that, you know, dying in all sorts of ways. They're apparently in Russia, it's almost a sport to fall out of a high window. And a lot of these guys were tumbling out of windows. And I'm just thinking, is it really that slippery in these Russian buildings where they just keep falling out of the windows? But they were being assassinated. You know, some have drug-induced heart attacks. Some fall off mountains. You know, just some have helicopters that crash. So, you know, you really begin to think, I think there's something suspicious going on here. But then again, I'm cynical.
Well,
so,
Jeff, let's back up a second, okay? To the best of your understanding, how many oligarchs were there, according to Forbes?
Well, I think less than 100, how they defined it.
Less than 100.
Yes.
And how many of them have, let's just say in the last couple of years, shuffled off their mortal coils?
Well, a prominent businessman, and maybe they're not all oligarchs, but, you know, dozens of them, you know, but even if a fraction of them are oligarchs, you know, you're still talking a small group of less than 100. So even if the true billionaires were 10 of them, 11 of them, 12 of them, you know, that's a pretty high rate of fatality.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like it's, you know, 17, 20% of all of them versus 1/1000th of 1% or 8/100th of 1%, if I'm doing the math right, you know, with 82 deaths in 100,000 versus, you know, a dozen deaths in 100.
Well, that's the thing, Adam. That was kind of the end point of the article is, you know, even if only one of these guys, and again, you have heads of the big energy companies. I mean, that seems to be where most of the oligarchs have come out of, is the energy industry, which makes sense. That's the main export. It's the thing that keeps the Russian economy going, or energy exports. You know, there was this regularity at which these board of director heads, the chair of one of the big energy companies, apparently had a heart attack and fell out of a window. You know, it's amazing the things that keep happening to these guys. They're just very, very unlucky people when you get right down to it.
I would think that with any forethought, Russian oil magnates would avoid high hotels.
I would think they would avoid anything in Russia, but that's a flippant comment, because these people were dying all over the place. One of them fell out of a high window in Washington, D.C. Another one was in Spain. Another one was in South America. So, you know, it call me suspicious, but it does seem that there is a bit of a, I don't know, trend here that's not just coincidental.
Well, statistically speaking, Jeff, the evidence basically to me and to my limited understanding, would say we really need to look into this further. And, you know, and I guess the question that immediately comes to my mind after that is, okay, number one, is it possible to get a key man life insurance policy on a Russian oligarch? And what would the premium be?
Yeah, that would be interesting for us to go to an insurance company and try and insure a few of these guys. But you're right, they probably wouldn't insure them at all.
I don't even think, you know, given the nature of things, I mean, how do we take it to a reinsurer like Lloyd's of London? I bet they wouldn't even return our call.
Probably not.
You know what, that... You know what? That might actually be worth a try. Calling Lloyd's of London and seeing if they'll issue a key man policy on a Russian oligarch.
Hmm. Well, it's funny, Adam, because Lloyd's of London, I always thought in my more ignorant younger days, with a name like that, that must be, you know, the most discriminating of insurers. But apparently, they're like the ones that handle the stuff that nobody else wants, if you're willing to pay for it. And I'm thinking,
well, yeah, of course.
I think you're onto something. I think we go over and talk to them and see if we could insure the whole lot of them, because we don't know which one's going to drop dead.
The other thing is, theoretically, it doesn't matter who the beneficiary is, right?
Yeah.
So if we bought the policy, we paid for the policy, and, you know, let's say one of our insureds goes out the window, we get paid.
Yeah, the only problem we may run into is that little concept known as insurable interest, you know. And, you know, we're not a family member of the oligarch. We don't want to be a family member because apparently a lot of family members got killed.
Oh, no. We're not joining them. No. We're not joining them in their accidents. No.
So that may be the thing we'll run into, is we're not related or anything. And but we should try. We should try. I mean, this seems to be a very fertile ground for a big payout.
I think you're onto something there. I really do. And then, you know, and then the next question would be, is there or should there be some kind of like OSHA type, you know, organization? Because these guys seem to have a lot of accidents. And I mean, I'm thinking, shouldn't there be somebody basically keeping an eye on these guys to make sure that they're not going out windows and stuff?
You know what, Adam? I think that's a great idea. The only problem is I think the OSHA guys would be going out windows too.
Ah, yeah, I never thought of it like that. But yeah, I think you're right. The Occupational Safety and Hazard Administration checking your helicopter over before you take off?
Well, I can say...
Who knows, Jeff?
Yeah, after reading about so many of these people have died, stopped feeling sorry for myself having to work in the office with the fluorescent lighting and dealing with the drudgery of white-collar routines every day. It's actually not so bad compared to what these guys are going through.
Yeah. Listen, by the way, I almost forgot to ask you. I mean, you got a pretty wicked paper cut the other day on those reports. How are you faring with that?
I'm doing much better, thank you. You know, a couple stitches. And thank God for the comprehensive medical coverage plan the Omaha Bugle provides for us all. But yeah, things are going better. Lost a bit of blood, but tell all the employees about that when we have some more time.
Well, and again, you know, understand that obviously is not to minimize the plight of Russian oligarchs. You know, it's just to point out that there are certain hazards that go along with certain occupations. And, maybe one of the hazards, you know, in the world of oligarchs is you stay away from windows. There seems to be a preponderance of them going out.
So there are also a lot of drownings. One person apparently, but I almost forgot, one person basically set his own bed on fire with a cigarette. So, you know, it's just hazards everywhere for these guys. You know, you really feel bad for them.
Well, and he set his bed on fire and tried to put it out with what, petrochemicals?
I think he was already, and maybe he was already dead because of the bullets in his head. I don't know.
As you recall, that's what happened to one of the denizens of South Florida. He actually got caught between two rival gangs and was shot like 157 times.
I assume he was dead.
Yes, absolutely. That's a story for another show. I think we've explored and plumbed the depth of the oligarch mystery. I think we need to really think about, and this is my personal opinion only, but I think we really ought to have a chat with somebody over at, you know, Lloyd's and see if we can insure some of these guys. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think between the two of us, we could come up with some kind of, if nothing else, like a strategic interest in their survival, you know?
Oh, yeah. We're fairly creative. I think we can manage something.
Huh. Exactly. Well, listen, Mr. Weaver, we have reached that time on our show when it is time for us to bid a fond adieu. So from the Omaha Bugle Global News Network News Desk, this is Adam Von Romer.
Oh, and this is Jeff Weaver.
We're signing off for the night.
Absolutely.